Hello, everyone, and welcome to Film Strips, the podcast that's doing anything and everything in its power not to think about the climate report. I'm Dave Babbitt.
I'm Andrew Kanagieser, who longtime listeners may remember as the actual co-host of this show. Thanks, everyone, who has stepped up in the absence. But, you know, we're here to do what we do best, which is talk for a long time, and Andrew starts complaining about stuff. But if this is your first time tuning in, though, I guess all the more reason we throw it to Dave to tell those of you at home, who are we and what are we doing this episode?
Why, this is Film Strips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, throw it under the microscope, look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. However, the thing about it is this. Currently, we are on a minor hiatus from that at the moment. We are getting back to it relatively soon. But if you've been listening in, you'll probably notice that we've been covering... Oh, I never actually got to what the gimmick of the show is. The important thing is that each and every week, the films under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed on the preceding week, except for recently, where we put a pin in that. We are going to pick up with it. We will get to Catch 22 and then pick up with our regular schedule at that point.
Yes, we come at you once a week. Life comes at you even faster. But thank you to our beautiful rogues gallery of friends, previous guests, and... you know, everyone who's been willing to step up and give Dave and the listener at home a little bit more time to get off the beaten path. Because, let's face it, sometimes we watch a vendor's film and we have plenty of exciting places to go. And sometimes we watch a Richard Burton film. And do not.
Yes. So, with that said, we are still in the midst of a straight-to-video cycle of special bonus episodes that are not connected to one another to one another by actors or cast or anything else, aside from the fact that they are all straight-to-video films.
You know what they are all connected by, though?
What's that?
They all result in an episode featuring one Dave Babbitt.
Indeed. But putting that aside, yes, this is another bonus episode not connected to that cycle of bonus episodes. I know we'll make it way more complicated than it needs to be.
Oh man, we started our own multiverse.
Yeah, but in this instance, the last time you and me talked, Andrew, we were taking a look at films that sort of made us happy. You know, put us in a happy place and made us joyful and wonderful, and then it expanded into what are other things that make us happy, and then I got to rant about Doctor Who and bring up the end of the Stephen Moffat era, and that's a whole nother thing that we're not going to get back into right now.
Well, I got to learn a lot, and I talked about Columbo, and David didn't learn a lot, but that's only because, as I've often maintained, he has forgotten more about film and television than most people ever learn.
Debatable, but thank you for the compliment. But this week, we are here to do the exact opposite of that, because we are nothing if not masochistic on this program, and yeah, we are going to take a look at the films that I'm just going to call it the veto episode, and not as in Vito Corleone. We are talking about films that we would absolutely, under the right circumstances, veto from being discussed on the show, which admittedly on my side is a very, very, very small number of films, really, when you get right down to it, or at least covers a few select areas, but I know, Andrew, it might be a little bit different for you in this instance.
Well, I mean, that's sort of kind of what has been really rewarding about doing this show for almost 3 years now is, you know, they say journeys begin with simple steps, but you look back, or at least I look back as one of the hosts, and realize we have covered a remarkable amount of ground. I believe that currently we have, 163 canonical timeline episodes, which is not something I figure we'd be able to do from the outset. But also looking back and realizing that there were a lot of films, and we sort of touched on last week, that ended up being very pleasant surprises. And there have been a lot of moments where I've been very happy to realize that I was wrong to dismiss certain things. You know, but sort of the inverse of that is there were also other times where we're super pumped or we think it's going to be interesting, and for various reasons, it's not. But yeah, sort of parlaying off of our last bonus, this is, I guess, the yang to the yin. And in this case, it's not what are the films that we've seen that we've hated most, as much as what are films that we would just put our foot down on. And you know, you may have a small list. I'm trying to think, because I always want to sound smart and cool and urbane, like a real film guy on here. But, you know, for the longest time as a film student, you know, and especially as a young white dude in his 20s, there was almost that attitude of like, nothing, no film could be so controversial that I'd refuse to watch it. And, you know, sometimes that means watching something like Stan Brakhage's Autopsy, which, for those of you at home, is a, it literally does what it says on the tin, in full American avant-garde style. But then there are other films like, I think we brought it up last time, Gaspar Noé's Irreversible, where it's like, okay, I can see why many people refuse to approach this film object at all. And I think as we get into it, I'm probably not even going to have a principled reason for any of the films that I will absolutely refuse to watch or refuse to discuss for our podcast. One did dawn on me, though, and actually more than one did. But I guess before we get into that, David and I have what may be a shocking confession that there is, other than the first time we looked at Highlander 2 and famously lost that episode, there is a secret episode of Film Strips that never was. And that was because David, against all odds, couldn't make his way through the film. Dave, why don't you tell the good people at home what this story is?
All right, so way back in year one of this program, we were basically, particularly at that point, we hadn't really... We wouldn't really plan what we were doing in advance. It was really more just throw stuff at the other individual and see what sticks. And one of the titles that came up, and I can't even remember how we were going to get to it exactly and who we were following.
I think we connected through Helen Mirren, but I'm trying to remember when we looked at Helen Mirren.
See, we covered her when we did White Knights, amongst others, but I think this was before White Knights, even.
Oh, man, that was a movie.
Yeah, but the key thing is that going back, one point we were going to be taking a look at the infamous film Caligula. Now, let me be clear about a few things. I had actually seen Caligula long ago, back when I was in university, because I rented it knowing its reputation, thinking it's like, well, it's got to at least be interesting.
I have a feeling we rented it from the same video store.
There's only one in Waterloo that I can imagine that would have carried it.
yep.
But the key thing I will say about this, not only is it not interesting, it is like, this is hands down one of the just the most unpleasant, miserable, painful film viewing experiences I've ever gone through. And that was back, you know, in university when I subjected myself to a lot of crap at that time. And it was like pulling teeth to get to the end of that one. But I did it. And then, you know, years go by and suddenly Andrew declares, hey, what if we take a look at Caligula? And
well, in my defense, I have long maintained that awful train wrecks of movies tend to produce better episodes to listen back to than when we look at masterpieces. There are obvious exceptions along the way, but I honestly feel like you kind of have more clever commentary when you're mad about the film you're watching, rather than both of us agreeing for 90 minutes. Yeah, that scene was all right.
Well, you're not wrong. And here's the thing. On a production level, there is much to be said about Caligula, because it is one of the legendary disasters of cinema. And I will say this wholeheartedly. For those of you unaware of it, the straightforward version of it is this. It's a film written, I believe, originally the initial screenplay was by Gore Vidal, which should have been a good sign, about the infamous Emperor Caligula of the Roman Empire. Now, if you know this, along with being the inspiration for Judge Cal from one of the best Judge Dredd strips ever, highly recommend you go check that one out there, folks. He is, yes, the potentially out of his mind Roman emperor who engaged in all sorts of debauchery and weirdness.
Most people remember he made his horse a senator.
Yeah, which again, there is probably a great film to be made about it. The thing about it is that despite having Gore Vidal, despite having a cast that included Malcolm McDowell in the lead role.
Yeah, Helen Mirren, John Gielgud is in it.
Peter O'Toole.
Yeah, like, it's an esteemed cast. And, like, even going back, like, there are definitely parts where, like, the set design is pretty remarkable. Like, what it's doing in terms of mise-en-scène is maybe not breathtaking, but it is very interesting. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, wow, you know, this film has a lot going for it. Until a guy named Bob Guccione comes along.
Well, and here's the thing. Bob Guccione, famously involved with the adult entertainment industry. And yes, this was, I believe, originally intended to be his bid for respectability in some ways. And instead, he decided that during the middle of the night when they weren't shooting, he would take his usual performers from the usual types of films he made and shoot on these big, elaborate sets, all sorts of additional shots and scenes that would be added into the movie afterwards before its release. We're not going to get into the whole history of the 75 different versions of this film that exist.
Yeah, you thought the Snyder Cut was weird.
Yeah, but let's put it to you this way. Yeah, it's a film that lives in infamy for a reason. And the thing that occurred to me while I tried to watch it again for the show, two things occurred to me. One, I hate this movie. It is just miserably unpleasant on everything. There is nothing about it that I like. Absolutely nothing. But more to the point, in order to do a proper discussion of the film would require us to go into areas that a PG-rated podcast, generally speaking, cannot possibly do.
Yeah, so for those keeping score, this wasn't a case of prudishness as much as how on earth can we talk about this without having to Greek out, like, every other sentence?
Yeah, and it was just that that's what I, about, you know, an hour into rewatching this godforsaken three-hour miserable misery fest. And again, it's not just the, you know, the added content. And it's just, like, literally, it's a film where, despite the impressiveness of the sets, when you watch it, everything seems to have been designed to be as grimy and off-putting and miserable as possible at every single second of the film. And not necessarily to achieve any sort of artistic or thematic point. It's just there for the sake of it.
Yeah, it kind of feels like, I don't even know which one came out first, but it's sort of like other famous sort of controversially risque films of the period. Salo, or the 120 Days of Sodom, comes to mind.
Yeah.
Pier Paolo Pasolini's own very controversial film. And it, like, it's been years since I've seen Caligula, but you almost get the sense that they looked at something like Salo and they were like, hey, it turns out you can do whatever you want on screen. But they forgot to think of a reason why they were doing what they were doing. And for all of its failings, and I certainly understand people's hesitance to watch a film like Salo, you at least get the sense that Pasolini knew what he was doing with the material in ways that Caligula never really hits. Part of that's due to the editing, but also, I mean, the rule of thumb that we've talked about before is, like, if it takes you 3 hours of footage and you're still not sure what kind of story you're trying to tell, there's a problem here.
Yeah, although if you're Wim Wenders and that film is Until the End of the World, I'm still willing to go with you on that journey.
Yeah. And what a journey that was.
But you're not wrong. And I mean, and this is the thing, like, I mean, and there's a whole subsection of films like that where I would probably say we wouldn't cover Salo on the show. Not to mention that would take a lot of effort to get there on our part, that I more than I'm willing to put in. But I mean, other things like a Serbian film, I have not seen that. I have no desire to see it based upon the descriptions that I have seen it,
but then you get people who are like, no, man, this is actually one of the most politically savvy films ever. It's all about Balkanization. I'm like, draw me a diagram and explain where you're getting this from.
Well, yeah, and then there's things where, like, just, again, the certain films where it's just like, I don't care what it is. This sounds to be shocking for the sake of being shocking, like the Human Centipede trilogy. I don't need to subject myself to that. I really don't. And some people may feel the need to. Eric Roberts decided, I'm going to take a paycheck and appear in the third one. But, you know, Eric Roberts alone is not going to get me to watch your movie there, folks. Okay? At least not in this instance.
Well, exactly. If it didn't happen for the Expendables, good luck happening here. And, I mean, that's sort of like the struggle that we deal with. Because, yeah, bad or outrageous movies can often lead to very good episodes, but at the same time, like we touched on the last time you and I spoke, life is short and life is precious. Why would you set aside 2 hours to watch something that you know you are going to dislike?
Well, exactly. And there, I mean, and again, I am the kind of freak who, yes, there are films where I suspect I may not like it, but I may still watch it, but within certain parameters, okay? Like I said, I don't necessarily like David Ayer's Suicide Squad, but I am willing to occasionally rewatch it to try and take it apart to figure out all the ways in which it goes wrong, because I find that fascinating.
Well, yeah, same thing with Dawn of Justice. Like, I saw it months after you did, but I remember being, like, transfixed the whole time, because it's like, every scene has the potential to be interesting, but then pivots the wrong way every single time. How does that happen? Speaking of which, though, interesting proposition for you, David. They're called the Suicide Squad, and yet most of them die by the result of actions of others.
Ba-dum-dum. Yes, we will save the philosophical debate about this until you've seen James Gunn's The Suicide Squad. A superior Suicide Squad film, I may add.
I know people here, on the internet really seem to like it, so take that for what it's worth. Internet opinion and $2 gets you a cup of coffee. But, yeah, it's, I guess all that to say, though, is, I think there definitely are the obvious films that we're probably not going to cover. And it's not because, you know, they're beneath us or anything like that. I mean, I'm sure if somebody really wanted to hear a podcast of two guys talking about, you know, Cannibal Holocaust or some of the classic video nasties, which never fails to make me smile that the best term England came up with for obscene video content that was not legally allowed for sale was video nasty. But, you know, it's like there are other podcasts out there that are happy to cover that material, and that's fine. We support them. It's not that we're saying censor everything. It's just, well, there are certain areas or certain styles of film that don't really appeal to us, and, like, we're not the people equipped to have a good discussion about. But, I mean, I think what we really nominally 20 minutes ago were going to focus on is, in our case, though, there are the obvious ones, and then there are the less obvious films that we are never going to watch or cover on our timeline, even if it was the only point of connection. And so, you know, something like Caligula makes a lot of sense, or at least given our gimmick, our dynamic, sort of the audience that we try to cultivate, it makes sense that we would not watch a Serbian film, or, you know, The Angel's Melancholy, or any of the other in that vein. I guess, what are the surprising hot buttons you have, Dave, in terms of films that you will not consider as part of film strips?
And that's the thing. Like, a lot of what falls for me is very much in the range of what we've talked about. Like, Tinto Brass is not going to appear on the show here, folks. Okay? There's a reason for that.
Yeah, but it is easy to find. You just, instead of looking on Amazon, you go to something like RedTube and you can see it for free.
We're not trying to make recommendations here, folks, but
come on, Dave, monetize. It's been 3 years.
Yes, point of the matter, so things like that, not gonna happen. A lot of the Italian, yeah, that sort of very grindhouse exploitation, like, it goes to a level that, I mean, like, Abel Ferreira is probably about as far down the road we're willing to go here, folks, in this instance. Any further than that, that might be pushing it for us in this instance.
Well, and depending on the Abel Ferreira as well, you know, Fear City was fascinatingly grimy. I don't think, but I also don't really want to watch, like, the Toolbox Murders, you know?
Yeah.
It's, I mean, different directors have their own, sort of moments of excess, I guess. And depending on what director, sometimes you want excess and sometimes you need a whole lot of restraint to be able to sit through that. It's weird thinking of Fear City as a restrained film.
Yeah, exactly. But beyond that, there are a few places where I don't think I would be willing to go. I'm not going to sit there and say that this is a firm veto, but it's very much bordering on a firm veto, and that is probably most of Charles Band's career.
Who on earth is Charles Band?
Okay, so if you're probably familiar with things like the Puppet Master series, which is probably the more respectable.
Hey, I've seen Puppet Master. I rented it from a Blockbuster in Thunder Bay, Ontario when I was 14.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I mean, I'm not going to sit there and say I'm completely against Charles Band, but his Full Moon Entertainment, it's produced a lot of crap as well that just looks like the most, like, low-end schlock. I'm trying to remember, I think things like Evil Bong and The Ginger Dead Man are their responsible, or their features, which is like the most bottom rung, low as can be type of schlock there, to the point where it's like, you're not even necessarily trying to make a good movie. Why would I ever subject myself to this?
Well, this piggybacking thing off of that, I feel very similarly about Troma, because even though, as I understand, everyone who has met Lloyd Kaufman absolutely adores him, with his bow tie and everything, who we actually saw, we didn't speak to, because then we'd be forced to think of something polite to say to him, at Montreal Comic Con that one time. I understand, like, he is beloved in the industry, but you can't get around the fact that, especially, like, more recent Troma output, it all looks like it's shot on a handy cam with a production budget of $500, and it just looks cheap. And I'm not the type of viewer that revels in a film. Like, I'm not a B-movie type person, which isn't to say that I only watch the finer things, as much as, like, why am I gonna look at a film that looks amateurish and cheap, because there are many other ones that don't. Like, there's something, Evil Dead, the original, is amateurish, but there's a charm to it in ways that I feel like Troma almost makes part of its brand. And then it develops like this this very strong, like, cult audience around the fact that, no, man, these films are supposed to look terrible and be 70 minutes. But come on, this one has Mojo Nixon in it.
Well, you're not wrong. And this is the thing. And putting aside that, yes, Lloyd Kaufman actually does appear in James Gunn's The Suicide Squad. He's in the bar scene, folks. Take a look in the background. The point of the matter, I don't disagree with you. And I think that's my thing where I would say here's the difference. Like, Evil, I mean, here's the thing. When we say B-movie means something very specific to me. It means something where, yeah, it's, you know, not necessarily the A crew, but that doesn't mean that there isn't any, that there's no effort being put into it. What Kaufman and, you know, Charles Band at this point are doing are more like the grade Z movie there, where it's just so beneath and so cheap and so, you know, without, like, it's like the lowest common denominator for what you're trying to do.
Well, it's like, if it's visually and structurally indistinct from, like, you know, a passing grade student film, then I don't think it's responsible to ask people to pay a lot of money to go see it. You know, there's a reason that most of these films are not theatrically released, and that, and it's not because Hollywood's trying to keep the little guy down either.
Well, no, absolutely not. And this is not to say that Mr. Kaufman or Mr. Band shouldn't have their companies and shouldn't have their particular niche. But at a certain point, you've, you know, that niche is all you're servicing there. And it, I mean, and this is the thing where it's one thing to be true to your vision. Not that I necessarily believe that Charles Band has much of a vision when he's making something called Evil Bong.
Well, he pictures some dollar signs and the rest falls into place.
Well, yes. But I mean, it's one of these things where, like, I mean, if you, at a certain point, I mean, I just, there's a tackiness to it that I just can't get on board with. I just do not have any sort of positive thing to say. So I would say is one thing we can definitely say is probably never going to show up on the show.
No, Dave, it's like film jazz. You gotta pay attention to the edits that they're not making properly.
Aha. But on the complete opposite end of that, I wouldn't, again, I'm not saying that this is an outright veto, but let's say this, Andrew. The Hallmark movie. Would we ever subject ourselves to one of these on our little show here?
I've never seen a Hallmark film, I don't think. I know it only by reputation. Again, Hallmark movies to me, as we talked about in our Columbo Murder Under Glass episode, I've always had that sticking point because sort of generationally, like, we grew up in a time where a made-for-TV movie, you know, it wasn't the big event. Like, what was it? The Day After or things like that. You know, we grew up in a time where made-for-TV movie was code word for, well, it looks like a TV show and maybe has an actor that you remember from somewhere else and it's going to be pretty bad. And, I mean, obviously, like, as we've gone into great detail on in previous episodes, like, distribution has changed substantially since the year that we were born. And I mean, that's not to say that no good film will ever come out on TV as a first release or anything like that, but Hallmark doesn't seem terribly concerned about making films that do other than pander to the audience. And if you're trying to run a successful broadcast network, I mean, that's kind of what you want to do. But I also have to recognize that I am probably not the target audience for Hallmark movies.
Well, exactly. And on top of which, it feels like low-hanging fruit there. And that's what sort of, like, you take a look and, well, we'll get to this one here in a second, but there's a certain segment of the internet who will look at those films specifically for the irony and for quote-unquote comedy there. And that is one of those things where, yes, you end up with, I mean, it's like, yeah, you can make fun of them, but what's the point there? Like, I mean, there are certain, like, there are films that,
well,
are,
and for our purposes too, like, there are many other podcasts, you know, like, we're probably not gonna do better riffing on a Hallmark movie than the crew over at How Did This Get Made, right? You know?
Yeah.
It's sort of knowing your limit and playing within it.
Yeah. And, like, ostensibly, I'd like to believe that hopefully sometimes we bring some sort of insight or some larger issue to discuss to the film as well. And I don't think you're gonna find that with the 17,000 Christmas movies that Hallmark has cranked out in a 20-year span.
It's like, this episode, the meta is going to be, hey, when exactly did Kevin Sorbo lose his mind?
Yes, that was when he started starring in something called Hercules the Legendary Journeys and started believing his own hype. But we'll put that aside for now because we may one day get to Call the Conqueror. One day.
But see, Dave, I would like to intervene at this point, though, because I do have a couple ideas in mind for what my own vetoes would be, and sort of approaching it from the other end, because right now we realize that there's sort of like a distinct floor of quality or acceptability for movies that we're gonna put our time into and then put more time into talking about over terrible internet connections in terrible heat. What I would say, though, is so we don't look like snobs, I feel like there is also a category of film that is so far up its own nethers,
yes,
that even if it's being made as an art film or as a big, serious movie, I find that there are a lot of films in that domain that I simply have zero interest in ever talking about. And the one that kind of came to me earlier in the week was sort of unlocking a bit of a repressed memory, because we've looked at Lars von Trier before,
yeah,
correct?
Unfortunately, yes.
Yes, and I mean, von Trier, very much the enfant terrible, the iconoclast in that. I, in the last year, watched his most recent film, The House That Jack Built, starring Matt Dillon, and on paper, really well-constructed sets. Matt Dillon gives maybe a good performance, I don't know, but hey, Bruno Ganz is in it. And I was reflecting on it this week because I realized it is one of the only films I've seen where I can say it is as contemptuous of its audience as it is of all the characters in the film. And it's about 2.5 hours long. Short version is basically a long philosophical conversation between a serial murderer and someone who may be an angel, a devil, or his conscience. And it all doesn't really amount to anything. It's kind of like a Shaggy Dog joke. Spoilers, it ends with Matt Dillon finding himself in a chasm over hell, and he thinks he can get his way around it, and then he falls, and then the movie's over. But go back to our Mandalay episode for a bit more background on Von Trier. But I'm like, this is the kind of insufferable art film that I just cannot stand. And now we're going to talk about it. But film can be challenging. It can be controversial. What I really hate, though, is when it's sort of like Ricky Gervais syndrome, where it's like, look at how shocking we can be. Look at how in your face and bold. Hey, there's Uma Thurman. Let's watch her get her face pulped by a tire jack. And it's the whole thing where it's also an incredibly long and fairly dull movie. And it's like, when you have like a 30-minute scene of Matt Dillon being verbally abusive to a woman, and then murdering her, and then cutting off parts of her body, who does that serve? Right? Because it's one of those things where, oh, well, we're being critical of this guy and his misogyny. Well, he's still your focal point. Well, yeah, but we're also having Bruno Ganz's character constantly tell him that he's full of it and pointing out all of his delusions of grandeur. Yeah, but we still have to listen to the character tell us all of this. Like, what's the point in doing that? It's like a film that actively negates itself at every moment, and so all you're left with is 2.5 hours of watching horrid people without sympathy doing horrid things.
Well, this is the thing. Like, there are ways that can work. I have no faith that Von Trier would be the one to pull that off, because as I've, again, listened to the Mandalay episode, I have very little in the way of positive things to say about him as a filmmaker.
But that being said, though, like, you know, Von Trier, I've seen movies like Europa, and it's boring as you would not believe. And I've seen other Von Trier films like Antichrist, which is one of those films that many people simply will not sit down and see when they hear about what happens in it. And I think that is a film that comes close to being a modern masterpiece. And maybe it's just personal taste, or maybe it's just shifting the focus somewhat, or less is more. But yeah, for some reason, it's like I was thinking, yeah, Von Trier, current Von Trier, no real interest in ever looking at it, because it's like the edgelord on the playground. All they're looking for is a reaction. So if you, it's like bad pro wrestling. Don't boo them. Turn your back and don't react. And that's the easiest way to see him get fired.
Well, I mean, this is my thing. And I like to go along with the sort of art house thing, because it's like, I like a diverse array of films. I love art films. I love international films. I love a wide variety of films. But I agree with you. Here's the difference. Funny enough, this reminds me of a quote from, of all people, Robert Englund. Years ago, okay, in a Fangoria, they were interviewing him, and he was talking about, it's like, you know, people asking him about, you know, apologizing for the work he's done or the bad movies. It's like, you know, why would I ever apologize for being in some of the films I've made? It's like, you know, no other genre would ask you this. Nobody asks you when you make an extraordinarily boring 2-hour film or 2-hour drama to apologize for it. Yet somehow with horror, you know, if you make a, you know, measly, you know, a violent but at least moderately interesting, you know, 80-minute film, they're going to ask you to apologize for it.
Explain yourself. Yeah,
exactly.
And I mean, that's sort of what I also just want to avoid, the idea that we're purely approaching things moralistically. Yeah. Because I mean, especially horror, the satanic panic of the 80s, a lot of that was motivated by moral outrage. Whereas, like, House That Jack Built, it's not moral outrage as much as I'm like, who cares? What's the point?
Well, and this is a part of my one issue with a certain segments of art film. Like, I mean, particularly, and I think probably, you know, the name that lives in infamy for this is Jean-Luc Godard at this point. Like, you know, like,
at least Godard after, like, 1975.
But that's my thing. It's like, there's a point where it's like, Godard, you know, was worth kind of watching in the 60s. At a certain point, who the hell is he making a film for other than himself? And who, and again, it's the same
thing. And film theorists. Yeah. Don't forget film theorists.
Well, absolutely. And it's the same thing with like these museum piece art house shorts and that, where it's like, if I need tons of contextualizing information outside the film that has nothing to do with actually watching the film, who the, you're basically, if you're supposedly getting across an important point, congratulations, you have failed to communicate that to a, you're a wide audience at that point.
It, maybe a less extreme example would be someone like Chris Marker, the French filmmaker who is certainly beloved in film study circles, and literally nobody knows them outside of it. Marker makes films very essayistically, and, you know, I guess the two big ones are La Jetée, which is kind of interesting. It was weirdly adapted into the film 12 Monkeys, yeah. But it's also about 20 minutes, almost the same plot, and told nearly entirely through still photographs. And the other one is Sans Soleil, which I'm sure it's on Criterion. A lot of people hail it as one of the best movies ever made. I don't even really understand what it is other than footage of things. And it's like, because the other side of the coin is we can watch a movie and like it, but as the two guys that are trying to make a podcast about movies, what on earth do you even say about it?
Well, and that's the thing. And I mean, look, I mean, there are films that are made for the aesthetic for aesthetic sake. And I'm fine with that. And that, you know, that can be interesting. But it's when there are, to go back to your sort of initial entry point, films that are so far up their own posterior in this instance, it's the ones that think they're important that can be so easily insufferable because you start buying, they start to believe their own hype. And I mean, no. And it's the same, like, it's the same thing with Oscar bait movies where, you know, we're making an important statement and it, you know, we saw this, it was called Cradle Will Rock. And, again, that sort of smugness is just insufferable.
Exactly. The whole, they're there, dear. We're doing very important work in theater right now. You plebeians wouldn't understand.
Well, exactly. And it's like, what's this? Jonathan Frazen, the author. It's the same thing where it's like, I can't take you seriously, man. I just, anybody who is so that far up, up their own self about themselves like that, it's like, you know, you could be, you know, and I'm not going to say he doesn't have any talent, but it's so insufferable trying to make his way through his work. It's like, I don't care. Like, there's just no point in which I care about what you're doing to be able to even begin to assess what you're doing. And frankly, you just come off as a repellent person. So why should I even be bothered? So, but that's sort of moving into a separate territory.
Yeah. But I mean, maybe splitting the difference. So we realize maybe now's the time to drill down to specifics. So there's a kind of art film or sort of museum installation type film that we don't want to cover. And there's a kind of zero film that we don't want to cover either. I know one film that makes me inexplicably angry because it's all the worst tendencies of the MTV films turn it over to the kids while still thinking it's a big serious art film. And that movie is Zach Braff's Garden State. Which, from the first time I saw it, infuriates me. Because, on the one hand, everything that happens is so, it's so, like, 101, this is how you make a serious movie. But it's done so ineptly, and at no point do you ever get the feeling that Zach Braff realizes this. Because in his own mind, nah, man, we're making the new Easy Rider here. It's got the shins, and we make people take 30 seconds out of the film to watch a sad guy listening to it. It's got Natalie Portman being quirky. You got a guy in a suit of armor. You got Peter Skarsgård, and we're supposed to like him, which is impossible. We got an infinite abyss. That's a metaphor. We got a guy with a big house with no furniture. That's a metaphor. We got this weirdly self-righteous, look, Dad, I don't feel bad that I paralyzed my mom. It was your fault for giving me medication. It's just like, what? I know a lot of people love that film, and I know that it connects to them on a personal level. I used to listen to The Smiths because I listened to them at the exact right time in my life for it to be meaningful to me. I do not listen to The Smiths anymore. And I would just strongly encourage a lot of people that saw it when it came out and loved it, and bumped the soundtrack all the time, go back and just... If you can set aside personal attachment, I really do not think it was ever the film that people believe it to be.
See, it's the here's the thing about those kinds of films is that I was never, this is going to sound really weird, I was not somebody who was really plugged into the sort of teenage zeitgeist as a teenager of our era. I know, shocking admission from the guy who loves all things 1980s. But that was the thing. It's like, it's even the same thing as a kid. It's like, you know, there's that phase that a lot of people go through where it's like, you know, when you're teenagers and that you want to read fiction about teens. I had zero interest in that. Like, I could not care less about reading about teens when I was a teenager. If you ask me, it's like, I want to watch Millennium with Frank Black, this, you know, craggy face, you know, 59 to 60 year old man who's just, you know, looks like he's lived through hell. That was where my interests lie as a teenager here, folks. So, you know, to me, like, I skipped by that whole sort of Garden State phase. Having said that, on a similar note, and I would not say that this is something we would never cover on the show because I would say it might be worth covering at one point, is a film that a lot of people loved when it came out. And I will say, even my family kind of loved it at the time, and even myself. And that is Pleasantville. And that is a film.
I was actually thinking about that movie the other day. Like Joan Allen in a bathtub and Jeff Daniels as a sexy diner guy.
And it is a film that I have grown to hate with a thriving passion the years. Because
now, do you hate it so much that when you're talking about it, you go from black and white to like beet red and color?
This is not Red Dragon levels of hatred here, folks. So let's be clear, on a scale of things, very few things reach Red Dragon levels of hatred on this thing. Pleasantville comes close, though, because the thing about it that always irks me is that it's this film about, you know, how freewheeling things are and how wonderful things are and how change is inevitable and we have to evolve and grow. And it makes all sorts of parallels to real life instances and issues throughout it that give it the air of importance and that it's commenting on something important. The thing that has come to fundamentally bother me about the film, though, is that it's really, when it comes right down to it, it's about two teenagers who wander into this community that they don't really understand, don't know anything about, and then proceed to screw everything up for everybody else and never seem to take responsibility for that fact at any point.
Well, more than that, it kind of, the film valorizes that. No, it's listening to these teens, forcing everyone to change around them. That's the virtuous way. And I mean, I'm not going to pretend that there were things about the 1950s that definitely needed to change, you know, and thankfully in the real world, we did get important pieces of legislation, say, in 1964 about that. But I mean, like, it's also that idea of presenting, like, historical change very much for a white audience. Yes. With a film full of white people.
Well, on top of which, I mean, it fails to take into account the fact that this is not... The world they enter into is not indeed actual America. They are entering into a fictional construct of people who literally do not know better in this instance. This is where, you know, things like the Prime Directive from Star Trek exists for a reason here, folks. Do not interfere with a pre-warp society. I know that that's going to go over the heads of some. That's okay. Those who are in the know will understand what I'm talking about here. But that's the thing. It's like, it's just that insufferable valorization of, you know, these kids who know better than everybody else. And again, things like, part of it's also like, even the closing shots of that film where, you know, William H. Macy is replaced by Jeff Daniels. That closing illusion there where it's like...
Yeah, it's like the anti-Shining.
Yeah, where I'm just looking, it's like, am I really... You know, you look at William H. Macy's character in this film, it's like, what did he do that's wrong? What is his... What is bad about him that he needs to be replaced? What makes him, you know, like, what is, you know, it's a film that feels like it's beating down on him for simply being a very simplistic individual that he is in this instance. And viewing, it's like, well, that's bad.
Well, you can also only have so many, like, real world social analogs in a film that's about kids entering a TV show.
Yeah.
And I mean, given its premise, though, you would not think that it ends up being as self-important as it is.
Well, exactly. And that's the, like, that film just it rubs me so wrong on so many levels there.
Well, it's like we looked at That Thing You Do, which almost does feel to have a similar vibe to it, but like the difference is it sort of it knows what register it wants to play in, where it's more like, hey, wasn't the era where you could be an overnight sensation and come back to reality, like, wasn't that a heck of a ride? Look at how fun it is to have, like, 60s nostalgia and teeny bopper culture in that. You know, and while we certainly mocked some choices in the film, like, it's also not a film that at any point decides to make a big, important statement about modern society either.
Yes, and yeah, exactly. I mean, Tom Hanks is making a film about, well, here's this sort of zany 60s comedy, sort of in the mold of things I grew up watching, and that's what all it is. Like, I mean, and that's fine. I think that's where a lot of films go wrong, where they try to be more than what they are, or trying to aim for things that probably shouldn't be. It's not that you shouldn't have ambition. You should have ambition, but there's a difference between being ambitious and being self-important, and you need to make sure that you keep that line firmly in check.
Oh, I got another veto. Anything directed by Sofia Coppola.
I may push okay, back, but...
I will straight up admit, I have not ever seen Lost in Translation, nor do I have an interest to, because Bill Murray, I have seen him do fine dramatic performances. Life Aquatic is one of my personally meaningful films, but I mean, I'm not so enamored with him that'll sell a film for me. Not a fan of Scarlett Johansson. Not a fan of weird Orientalism. Not a fan of being asked to feel bad for people with money who can't have one thing that they want. I'm just not interested. I've seen Virgin Suicides, and it's like, this is a film that tries very, very hard. And Marie Antoinette, like David Rees, cartoonist and essayist, I think he said it best when he was like, oh cool, a film about Marie Antoinette. I'm just really glad that they ignored all of the starving peasants so we could get really nicely framed shots of her footwear.
See, and it's the thing, I will say this, I don't think Sofia Coppola is a great filmmaker. I think she occasionally makes fascinating messes, however, of which I think Marie Antoinette is. I don't think it's necessarily a good movie, but I am fascinated by it. Lost in Translation is just plain bad. Again, that was one of those ones where it's like, yeah, this is kind of great, and realize over time it's like, no. No, it's not at all.
What do you mean Crash is a bad movie? It won an Oscar.
Well, that one was just always bad.
Says right here, best picture. So,
that much like Driving Miss Daisy, it was always a bad movie here, folks.
Well, I mean, also, you know, there are also certain films that, you know, really kind of come out at the right time. Like, how many people have watched the movie The Artist since it came out?
I love that this is your one that you always come back to on the show.
Well, because it's true, because I saw it in theater, I enjoyed it a lot. I have never had any occasion to think, that's a movie I'd like to rewatch.
See, and I think this is the thing. I think the problem with The Artist was that was one that got hyped up from the outside. I don't think, it's one of those films where I think if the people outside of it who were hyping it up had just kept their mouths shut, it would probably be enjoying a much quieter but more consistent enjoyability over the years since then.
It also links us to Caligula, because Malcolm McDowell is in both. And it also has John Goodman, so I'm kind of fascinated that we haven't gotten.
Yeah, well, we like so. There's plenty of a John Goodman we'll still get to one of these days. Red State, I'm sure we'll get to Red State one day.
Oh yeah, or 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Also a good movie.
You know, it's just good enough. It's again, it's sort of sometimes like it's not that I want films to be banal. But I don't want them to be self-important either. And sometimes you can only, like, figure that out, whether or not a film succeeds, after you've seen it. Because I'm like, all right, well, a movie that's just about hanging out in a fallout shelter, not all that interesting. But I don't know if suddenly being like, oh, and in overcoming this obstacle and fighting aliens, I've learned to overcome my PTSD from surviving assault. It's like, I don't know if that's the bridge you want to cross with this perfectly adequate film. I don't know. A lot of it is personal taste. You know, if anything's been clear over the last two bonus episodes, like, it's very difficult to sit down and think prescriptively, like, here's what I want out of a movie and here's what I don't want. I don't ever want to watch, like, a Merchant Ivory film because I simply do not care. It's trying to think of anything else here. I mean, the other piece is, as I've certainly intimated, got a lot going on in my life most times, and I got a lot going on in my life right now. And it's just like, there is so much when you step away a bit, you realize there are many things that you simply do not care about. And so, even if a film doesn't necessarily make me angry, it's just like, well, why this one and not 50 comparable films that are just like it? But, I guess getting back to the beginning, though, that has been the continual source of surprise, delight, and joy in doing this show with you, because I don't think otherwise I would have had an occasion to sit down and watch films like True Stories or, you know, even a film like Aftermath. I probably wouldn't have sought that out on my own. Maybe not fantastic, but it's interesting. I mean, Human Highway, certainly having somebody to talk about it with made it a lot of fun. You know, and just even looking at Princess and the Frog, that was cute. Memoirs of an Invisible Man. Okay, I'm vetoing any Chevy Chase film. My Blue Heaven was an absolute treat. And it's just the fact that, you know, as I just said, like, you don't really know what you're getting into until after it's happened. And I do have to give you credit, Dave, because you have brought me along for films that, you know, I didn't think I would have much of a reaction to Bigger Than Life reading about on paper, and that has been one of the films we've covered that I probably thought most about since watching. And so there are good surprises and there are bad ones, and, you know, that's also sort of why it's hard, because even a filmmaker like Von Trier or Godard, they can have their good surprises and they can have their bad ones. Sometimes it is Breathless. Sometimes it is Pierrot Le Fou. Sometimes it's Weekend. Sometimes it's Tout Va Bien. And sometimes it's King Lear with Woody Allen. You know, I don't know. Like, it's hard to really think of much more because I don't want to limit myself. The one thing I can say, though, is that across 3 years, I've really grown to appreciate and trust your judgment because I don't remember the last time we were saddled with a film that we had literally nothing to say about. And with that, I'm going to look at the list and see if I can remember.
I will say on this note, in order to help continue to avoid it, there's one other area I will say of types of films we will probably never cover on that show. Anything produced by any of the following people: Red Letter Media, The Nostalgia Critic, anybody associated with The Nostalgia Critic, anything that they put out that sort of tries to pass itself off as a film in this instance. No, we're not going there. There is no way to make any of those things tolerable or sufferable in this instance. So let's just pretend that those things don't exist and acknowledge that and move on.
Well, support local creators, support independent artists. I mean, there was a time in my life where Angry Video Game Nerd was a highlight whenever a new video dropped. I am not going to pretend that I have any interest whatsoever in seeing a feature-length film made by the same guy. I guess if anything, though, maybe that's the positive point we can come back to, which is film is always a lot broader and more diverse than you might think, and that means there's always something out there for whatever audience there is. But yeah, I'm totally okay not watching a film by nostalgia critic.
Yeah, I think we should all be so lucky on that note.
Who sits down, they're like, oh, this montage of a guy screaming hysterically because he keeps losing at Mario Kart? I could use 90 more minutes of this.
Yeah. But apparently there is an audience. God help us all for that one.
We need a Bennett the Sage movie because, oh man, that guy could read the phone book and make it entertaining.
Could he, though?
We're really showing our age in this episode.
Yeah, so before we feel any older than we already are, as this planet of ours heads towards its collective doom, Andrew, where can people reach out to you and let you know about the films they would like to see us veto for future including? Not that we'll necessarily do that.
You can let me know over at FilmStripper, or by emailing the show directly at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. Tony actually sent us an email last week saying, when are you guys doing the Nostalgia Critic movie? And I think we now have an answer. Sorry, Tones, but I guess every dog has its day, but today ain't yours, dog. Dave, where can people get in touch with you?
People can reach me at 24 Panels. No, I am not vetoing the remaining Highlander films. We will watch those. That's a given at this point here, folks. Okay?
There can only be seven.
Like I said, we've got the animated one, we've got the Source, and we've got Endgame still to visit. Maybe we'll skip the Sword of Vengeance, but we'll see. But putting that aside here as well, Andrew, let's just say people wanted to rate and review us on this little program. Where can they do so?
Easiest way to do that is wherever you download this podcast, namely Apple Music. 5-star reviews help move us up the featured charts and get new eyes and ears on our humble little program. More importantly, that's just another place where you can leave some quick feedback. Let us know what's working for you and what isn't, because across 163 episodes, 3 years, and a whole bunch of side content, all David and I have wanted to do is to bring you a show that you want to listen to.
Absolutely. So with that, are there any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'm going to hope you hit this one out of the park, and I'm genuinely curious how you will. But remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
If you were subjecting yourself to Caligula, monotony did you a favor. Bye.
Or global warming, I guess.